Hey, I'd like to welcome everybody to session 224, Hamblin and Twila, Making of a Pacifist. And Todd Compton is going to be presenting today. I'd like to remind you to turn off your cell phones or pagers or other noisemakers you have. If you go ahead and just take a moment and pull it out and look at it, make sure that it's on silent or vibrate. I prefer vibrate, but that's just personal preference. Todd is an old friend of mine I've known for a long time and enjoy him. I was talking to his mother-in-law, who actually likes him as well. She had a little anecdote about Todd that when he was on his honeymoon, they were somewhere down in New Mexico, and they stopped at some small town and actually did historical research for his book during his honeymoon. And I asked if Laura thought that was a good idea, and she was happy with it, so they have marital harmony, which is always a good thing. The other respondent is going to be Brent Johns, and I've seen him around at Sunstone many times over the years, but my claim to fame is that I used to be on an email list with his wife, Becky, who's a really nice person and interested in history as well. I'll go ahead and turn the time over, since you've had an opportunity to turn off your cell phones, etc., to Todd, and then we'll have some questions and answers later.
I'm working on a biography of Jacob Hamblin, and this will be an oral condensed version of a rough draft of a chapter, the chapter of Jacob Hamblin in Twila. So, what happened with Jacob Hamblin is he crossed the plains in 1850, and he was assigned to go to Twila, and about 2 weeks later, after he arrived in Salt Lake City, September 6th. On the 20th, he came to Twila. And Twila had been a settlement for about a year at that time. Twila, early descriptions of Twila emphasize it as a grasslands. They do not emphasize it as a place, you know, that would be ideal for agriculture. And water resources were quite limited. And so originally Twila was used as a place for forage for cattle, and so the Mormons pretty early started taking their herds out to Twila. And descriptions say, you know, these grass, you know, really high, 2 feet grass throughout the valley. In Twila Valley, in the valley to the west of it, and in general area, and then in the big valley to the west of that, lived the Native Americans, Indians called the Goshutes. And just a little bit about the Goshutes. I have more in my chapter, but in my chapter I try to explain all of the Utah Indians. And the Goshutes were not one of the more dominant, wealthy groups of Indians, like the Utes. And they were not horse Indians. They did not have really rich resources for hunting like the Utes did in the mountains. And they were in fact known as digger Indians because they dug for roots, and a lot of what they ate were lizards, groundhogs, these things. According to some of the early sources, occasionally they would be able to kill an antelope, but they didn't have a lot of guns. A couple of early descriptions of the Goshutes. In 1859, James Simpson, during his explorations of the Salt Lake Desert, came upon some Goshutes. And he wrote, "We have today seen a number of Goshute Indians. They are the most wretched-looking creatures, certainly the most wretched I have ever seen. And I have seen great numbers in various portions of our country." And he described their rabbit skin clothes and so on. And And he said, but they offered but a scant protection to the valley. They subsisted on rats, lizards, snakes, insects, grass seed, and roots. And that's very important, the grass seed and the roots. The grasses in Tooele Valley were very important for their survival. And I have two or three quotes where the early witnesses of the Goshute said they were the most wretched Indians I've ever seen. And so the Mormons were coming into this ecosystem. And historian Daniel Difa describes the Mormon colonization in Tooele as a disaster for the Goshutes. In October 1849, a company of men under the direction of Ezra Taft Benson entered the Tooele Valley to begin the construction of a sawmill. This was the first permanent encroachment into Goshute territory. This large non-Indian population, it increased year by year, and Jacob Hamblin was part of this increase. This large non-Indian population placed the Goshutes in a desperate situation. The Indians had long been accustomed to placing their camps near streams and canyons to take advantage of the water and food supply there. Well, where are Mormons going to settle, you know, to start their irrigation? Because in Tooele, of course, they were going to become farmers, and so they would have to use their irrigation. Well, they were going to settle in the exact same places. These white settlers brought with them the idea of exclusive use of natural resources and robbed the Goshute of many of the things they need to survive. And you'll notice the tone here is a little bit different than the triumphal, you know, spread of the wonderful Mormons throughout the West. So there's a real paradoxical element to Mormon settling of Utah and the Southwest, you know, from the Native American point of view. So the culture clash of white and Indian was beginning in the context of Mormon settlement. When we examine how historians have dealt with Mormon policies toward Indians, there is a divide between scholars who believed Brigham Young pursued largely humane and far-sighted policies with Utah's Indians, and those who believe his policies were often more keeping with harsh American traditions. However you view Young, he was an energetic colonizer who endeavored to plant permanent Mormon settlements throughout the Southwest. And, of course, Mormon settlements can be found now in Utah, Nevada, Arizona, Colorado, Wyoming, California, Mexico, Old Mexico, and Canada. Often these settlements came into conflict with traditional territory of Indians and took advantage of their precious water resources. In addition, Mormon livestock often overgrazed and destroyed plant resources that Indians depended upon. The two more impoverished group of Indians, the Goshutes and the Paiutes, would be hardest hit by Mormon incursions into their territory. And another thing the Goshutes and Paiutes had to deal with was that the more powerful Indians, the Ute Indians, often would make raids on their territory and steal their women and their children. And so both the Goshutes and the Paiutes are described by early witnesses as very secretive and afraid of anyone who came into their territory. And one witness says that Goshutes often did not live by water resources, though they had to use them, because then they would be open to invaders. So though the Mormons felt they had a right to settle in Indian lands, Brigham Young and Jacob Hamblin typically exercised more restraint with Indians than many white settlers. And Howard Christie, in his article Open Hand and Mailed Fist, argues that Young was initially more retributive and gradually came to have more moderate policies toward the Indians. And he notes that a number of punitive campaigns carried out against Indians between March 1849 and June 1851. So that's just a little background on Mormon Indian relations in Tooele. Okay, and for the rest of this talk, I'm going to concentrate on two confrontations. And one, Jacob Hamblin may have been kind of a witness, kind of as a soldier. And the other one, he was a major participant in. Okay, so it is described briefly by Jacob Hamblin in his holograph autobiography. And he wrote, he kind of had someone named James Little ghostwrite autobiography of his that was published. But we also have a holograph autobiography that he wrote that's it's really important that you look at both of these when you look at the events in his life, because often the holograph gives more perspective, an earlier perspective than the published autobiography. And this is what Jacob wrote about this incident I'm going to talk about. There was several attempts made to stop them, the Indian raids. Oh, so Indians start to make off with Mormon cattle. Okay, so there were several attempts made to stop them, but to no effect. There was one expedition under the command of Captain Porter Rockwell, the famous bodyguard of Joseph Smith. He took some 20 or 30 Utahs near a fresh lake, 7 or 8 miles from our settlement. While coming in to the settlement, an affray took place in which one Mr. Custer was killed, an immigrant, a non-Mormon. The prisoners made their escape and fled except 5. And these 5 were taken out and shot. Okay, and I should mention that the relationship between the different types of Indians in Utah was very complex. And even though the Utes would make raids into Goshute and Paiute territories and carry off prisoners to trade with down in New Mexico, they also sometimes had alliances and marriage alliances with the Goshutes. And the earliest description of Black Hawk, who was later the leading figure of the Black Hawk War, is given by a diarist in this territory, in the Goshute territory, because he had a Goshute wife. And so the Utes did have some influence and some alliances in Tooele territory. And so here Jacob Hamblin says explicitly these were Utahs that were taken prisoner. Okay, so other sources allow us to fill in important details in this incident. Shortly before April 21st, 1851, and again I say Jacob Hamblin wasn't a major player in this, but he may have been part of the group under Porter Rockwell, because he describes it in his autobiography. Okay, shortly before April 21st, 1851, some non-Mormons were helping Mormons build a dam for Apostle Benson's mill in Richville, northwest of Tooele City, when Indians stole their horses. The Tooele residents quickly notified Salt Lake, and on the same day, General Daniel H. Wells sent out a company of volunteers under the leadership of Orson Porter Rockwell, the legendary Mormon gunman, to recover the horses. The next day, the posse of Salt Lake volunteers, Tooele volunteers, and non-Mormons came to Rush Lake, some 17 miles southwest of Tooele, and there evidently mistook the route the marauders had taken. And that's a quote from Tullidge, who tells this story, and I'm going to read that in a little more context because it's so important. Okay, he says, "The Mormons followed them, the horse thieves, as they supposed, to the west side of Rush Lake," this is Tullidge speaking, "but evidently mistook the route the marauders had taken." So he says they got off the trail. However, they there found a band of Indians with their families. So instead of the horse thieves, they found a band of Indian with their families, took them prisoners, and started for Tooele. So in other words, they had the wrong Indians. They did not have the Indians who had wrestled these horses. And that's how I read that paragraph. And this is a really interesting, I mean, it's, you see it again and again through the West, of the wrong Indian. You kill the wrong Indian. You know, Indians do, you know, steal something, and then you go and find the nearest Indian and kill him, you know, who had nothing to do with it. And Mormons did it kind of in the same way. It's if an Indian did something bad, you go out and kill the first Indian you can find. And Indians did the same thing with Mormons. They would kill innocent Mormons at times. Okay, so Rockwell, in a questionable decision, decided that 30 of these Indians should be taken as prisoners to Tooele and disarmed. When the group came close to Twila at about twilight, some of the Indians moved forward to Twila willingly, but others hung back and began to scatter. The best account of what happened then is written by a non-Mormon, W.R. Dickinson. And he wrote this in a letter, dated May 25th, 1851. So that's a really wonderful early source. And he wrote, Custer spurred his horse to get round them, the Indians that were kind of drifting off. He then pulled his revolver, pointed at the engine, shot. So who shot first? The white. Another engine got Custer. So an Indian shot in defense, kind of, and shot Custer. I shot the Indian that shot Custer. Okay, so Custer shot an Indian he may have thought was trying to escape. Another Indian returned fire, killing Custer. This Indian was then shot by Dickinson. So all of these, but remember, all of these Indians were innocent of the horse wrestling. And even in the horse wrestling, no one had been killed. So Porter Rockwell, in his report to Brigham Young, left out the detail that Custer fired the first shot, making it appear that Custer was the victim of an unexpected and unprovoked attack. And this was kind of the line that has been taken in later Mormon accounts of this conflict. In a later retrospective account, the truth has been embellished further, painting the Indians as even more cowardly. And Marianne Maughan, who was a resident in Twila, in her autobiography wrote, Mr. Custer, being a little behind the others, two or three Indians dropped behind him and shot him in the back. Okay, so this is kind of typical how the truth gets embellished in a partisan way and an anti-Indian way, and why it's wonderful when you have early sources to balance things out. And another early Twila historian writes this, Custer fell asleep in the saddle, the Indians steal his gun and shoot him. Okay. Compare that to what we know happened from a near contemporary source. It paints the Indians as horrible, terrible, and it's totally unfactual. Okay, so eventually the Indians scattered and Rockwell was only able to keep four prisoners. Different sources say five, but I think four is the earlier number that's reliable. The next day, he and his men took the prisoners past modern Grantsville, crossed the Stansbury Mountains into Skull Valley, still looking for the horses. When they found nothing, and the prisoners stated that they knew nothing of the stolen horses, which was correct, Rockwell killed them. You know, that's the solution to the problem. Even though they hadn't killed Hester, Custer had not wrestled the horses. And so the author I mentioned early, Tullidge, writes this. Rockwell and his men, not finding any trace of the stolen horses, deemed it unwise to turn the thieves in their power loose to commit more depredations and perhaps shed the blood of some useful citizens. And notice that... notice that the one who fired the first shot was a white. And in the wrestling of the horses, there was no white killed. And perhaps shed the blood of some useful citizens, and they were sacrificed to the natural instincts of self-defense. You know, think about that. Isn't that a horrifying, scrubbing clean of what was a terrible murder? And when I mentioned this to a friend of mine, he said, you know, it's interesting. When you look at all of the lore of Porter Rockwell, he's supposed to have killed this white and this white and this white. And it's controversial. Mormons deny it. But when he killed four defenseless Indians, you know, Tullidge almost lauds him for doing this. Okay, in the larger context of Mormon-Indian relations at this time, we have to say that Rockwell was kind of working within a context. And the Mormon military had a policy of taking no prisoners. And on February 9, 1850, Daniel H. Wells, who was in charge of everything, of the Nauvoo Legion in Utah, wrote to General George D. Grant, take no hostile prisoners, and let none escape, but do the work clean. Okay, thus the mailed fist was in evidence in these early conflicts with the Indians. Killing Indians was not just allowed, but sometimes ordered, and often negotiations were not even attempted. Instead, the adversarial military point of view prevailed, which judged success by the number of enemies killed. And you read some of these wonderful early territorial letters, and it's very striking how they have this point of view. The goal is to, you know, is a body count of Indians. The Indians are starting, we see them as the other at this point. Okay, so that's a little background, and I think Jacob Hamblin might have been an eyewitness to that. We're not sure, but he does include it in his holograph autobiography. Okay, so now I'm going to look at... The famous account of Jacob Hamblin confronting an Indian in the mountains that, by his account, brought about his conversion to a different point of view than this point of view we've just talked about, where the body count of the Indians is what you're looking for. Okay, so the very first piece of evidence about, we have four accounts. We're really lucky. We have four accounts of this confrontation. And it's interesting to see the development over time, and it's interesting to see the different points of view in these four accounts. But the earliest one, is written by Hamblin's immediate military superior, Captain Phineas Wright. It's dated March 15, 1852, which was the last day of the expedition that Hamblin was part of. And Hamblin had been made a lieutenant, and he was sent on an expedition to punish Indians who had made off with some livestock. Okay, so it's the report of Phineas Wright, but Phineas Wright hadn't been there. He wasn't there. Hamblin was the chief military officer. And so, obviously, Hamblin came back and made a report to Phineas Wright, and Phineas Wright wrote it up. And so, it's, I would say, you know, almost 95% Jacob Hamblin here. But there might be a little bit of Phineas Wright putting it in his own words. Okay, so I'm going to read quite a bit of this. It's such a remarkable document. And it starts out with a list of all the members of the expedition. And then Phineas Wright, or Hamblin, writes, "March the 12th, we received an express from Grantsville that the Goshiyut Indians were in the Tooele Valley, fresh tracks being seen, also being told by the Indian that lives at Grantville. We proceeded forth to Grantsville the next day. About 10 o'clock, came upon the Indians, six in number, camped on the side of the mountain, 18 miles west of Grantsville. The company of Mormons, being discovered by their sentinel about a half mile before reaching the camp, which gave the Indians a chance to scatter on the mountains before our men could get to them or break off their retreat. However, the most active of them, of the Mormons, succeeded in heading one Indian who was skulking behind some rocks." And the Mormons had an Indian with them named Jack who was helping them. "The Indian Jack, so-called, that lives at Grantsville, being alone with the along with the company, shot at the Indian skulking behind the rocks and missed him. At this, the Indian in the rocks sprung after Jack with a volley of arrows, Jack running towards Lieutenant Hamblin, who was watching the movements and leveled at his breast on the approach of the Indian, which did not see Hamblin until he got within 25 feet of him, when Hamblin's gun missed fire. The Indian then directed his arrows at him and kept coming closer, at which Hamblin gathered a rock and hit the Indian full drive in the breast, which made him turn on his heels and run. This gave Hamblin time to put on another cap on his gun and fire at him on the run, but his cap busted the second time, and the Indian got away. The caps were some that he had borrowed, which proved no good." And my brother-in-law, Ladd, explained to me yesterday how this kind of gun worked. The caps kind of provided the primer that would send the spark down into the gunpowder in the barrel. And if you don't get that spark, the gun will not go off. And so his caps would not work. Okay, Phineas Wright slash Hamblin continue, "However, the rest of the company was blazing away at them the best they could, and some of the Indians was badly wounded, so supposed by the blood on the rocks, as they followed them some 5 miles. In their flight, they left their moccasins, all but one, and took their flight barefooted." End of report. Okay, and just to jump ahead just a little bit, this was the incident that converted Hamblin toward believing that he should never kill Indians and having a spiritual experience. But notice how little of that spiritual experience is in this military report. And it kind of ends on the triumphal note that we wounded them, there was lots of blood, and we made them run away. Okay, so that's kind of a typical military report there. However, no one was killed. Okay, and that was the important thing for Hamblin in his later life. Okay, and in Hamblin's holograph biography is the next account, and I won't read it. I'll read one little bit here. And Hamblin says, "I met one of them, one of the Indians who was fleeing. As I raised my gun to fire, the poor fellow begged for mercy. I thought it would be a neglect of duty if I let him pass, but my gun missed fire. As quick as thought, he threw an arrow at me, but fortunately it struck the guard of my gun. We both sprung for a rock that lay between us. I evaded two more of his arrows, threw a stone at him, and so he passed by. I burned two more caps at him, but my gun would not go." Okay, several of the company had fair shots close by, but their guns missed fire. "We felt vexed at first of all our ill success." Okay, this is the typical military point of view. You know, this was a failure. You hadn't killed anyone. "Of our success, as we killed none of them. But we concluded it was all right, that the Lord had use for them, so we returned home." Okay, so there's just the little hint that he's starting to see a divine miracle in this confrontation. And the next account I have is by Thomas Atkin Jr. It's a memoir. And he tells the same story, and it's, you know, wonderful to have one more account that talks about this. But his account, I'll just summarize it. It's more like, this was an exciting Indian story. And our captain, Jacob Hamblin, overtook one of the Indians and tried to fire on him, but his rifle missed fire. The Indian turned on him with his bows and arrow, but Jacob finally put the Indian to flight by using some of the abundant supply of rocks. In self-defense, our short expedition checked their depredations for a while. Okay, so his emphasis is on, again, the triumphalism. Our expedition checked their depredations. It was a success. There's nothing of the spiritual nature that Hamblin has. So finally, in the last account, it's this published autobiography of Hamblin that Little helped write. Okay, and so in this, and again, this is very retrospective, but I don't think that automatically means it isn't true. It gives Jacob's later view of the incident. So he writes, "After this affair, when Hamblin had brought Indians back to Tooele, and his military commander, who was also his ecclesiastical commander, was upset that he hadn't killed them, that he brought them back. The presiding elder was probably John Roberry, who was the presiding elder and the presiding military commander. The presiding elder directed me to take another company of men, go after the Indians, to shoot all we found, and bring no more to the settlement." Okay. That's very much the mailed fist, isn't it? And again, remember, the Indians hadn't killed anyone. But so it seems harsh. To me, it sounds non-Mormon. But that's the way it was. "Again, we traveled all night and watched during the day. We found the trail of a small band. We surprised them near a mountain between Tooele and Skull Valleys." And by the way, in the four accounts, the confrontation takes place in totally different places, but we don't need to worry about that. "They scattered in the foothills, and the company divided to the right and left. I rode my horse as far as he could go on account of the difficulty of the ground, then left him, and secreted myself behind a rock in a narrow pass, through which I presumed some of the Indians would attempt to escape. I had not been there long before an Indian came within a few paces of me. I leveled my rifle on him, and it missed fire." He tried to kill the Indian. He sent an arrow at me. It struck my gun as I was in the act of recapping it. He sent the second, and it passed through my hat. The third barely missed my head. The fourth passed through my coat and vest. As I could not discharge my gun, I defended myself as well as I could with stones. And in that general description, it might seem a little much, but that general description is supported by the very early military report. The Indian soon left the ground to me. And he learns that other people in the expedition tried to kill the Indians. No one was able to kill any of the Indians. In my subsequent reflections, it appeared evident to me that a special providence had been over us in this and the two previous expeditions to prevent us from shedding the blood of the Indians. The Holy Spirit forcibly impressed upon me that it was not my calling to shed the blood of the scattered remnant of Israel, but to be a messenger of peace to them. It was also made manifest to me that if I would not thirst for their blood, I should never fall by their hands. The most of the men who went on this last expedition also received an impression that it was wrong to kill these Indians. So that's very typical of Hamblin. All kinds of experiences he has, he looks back on them as miraculous, and as things that are special messages to him from God. But this is why he said that in his later dealings with Indians, he felt that he was protected by God, that he would never be killed if he did not wish to shed their blood. And I think it's remarkable, especially if we take into consideration the military mindset that we saw in the earlier story I showed you, and the mindset of the military / ecclesiastical leader who sent Hamblin on this expedition. So this was the crucible that created the Jacob Hamblin of southern Utah up here in Tooele. Thank you.
I'm going to make this extremely short because Todd and probably many others in the audience are much more of an expert than I am. I describe myself as a reader of history and an enjoyer of history. And this month I've had a couple of fun experiences, and reading this paper has been one of them. The other one has been the rebroadcast of the Civil War epic by Ken Burns, starting last Sunday on KBYU, one of my favorite pieces of television ever. I really enjoyed reading Todd's paper. It's really in a rough draft form, and I wanted to do a Levine on it and start editing and correcting all of the, but that's not my job. The thing that appealed to me most in the chapter that he gave you a brief glimpse of today is the Indian interactions with the Mormons and the effect of the Mormon incursion into Indian territory. Obviously, it's all retrospective, and in our modern sensibilities, we would have a hard time seeing another people move into a territory populated by an indigenous people and having such a devastating effect upon their culture, their way of life, and their means of survival. And Todd paints a great picture of just how devastating this was. I had some problems understanding, and I don't know that I still understand the difference between the Goshutes, the Paiutes, the Utes, the Shoshones, and so forth. But he does paint a good picture, which he didn't have time to cover, of some of the interrelationships between the various tribes. The Goshutes are painted variously as really mean, verminous type of Indians that just are wandering around with their children all naked, their women hardly wearing any clothes, and the men at best having a loincloth of rabbit skins. And yet, at times you see in these reports of the Indians apparently making off with huge numbers of Mormon horses and cattle. I wonder to some extent, and I'm sure that Todd does as well, whether some of these incursions were perhaps of Utes coming up from Utah County into the Skull Valley and Tooele Valleys, Rush Valley, and making off with those horses and cattle, and the poor Goshutes who were on foot and not part of the horse Indians, having no ability to run and hide as well, being the ones that then are there and receive the brunt of the retaliation from the Mormon battalion and the people in Tooele and so forth. I also was quite amazed at the size of the depredations of supposed depredations, and I wondered to some extent whether these were exaggerated. In the 1851 description in which poor non-Mormon Custer is killed, the report that goes to Daniel Wells in Salt Lake says that one of the residents of the Tooele Valley has 50 horses and cattle that are that have been run off and taken off by the Indians, which are never recovered. And you wonder how people that got to the Tooele Valley in 1848-49 at the earliest could have developed that size of herd. We don't hear of the Mormons coming across the plains with huge herds of cattle and horses, you know, especially at that point in time. And you know, given perhaps another 10 years, somebody that came over with two or three or four horses and a few oxen and so forth might have a herd of 50. But how did they have a herd of 50 by 1851? Total for one person. It just you know, maybe it's just part of the exaggeration, and again, as many of the retrospective accounts become larger and the depredations of the Indians reported to make them look worse than they are. Todd didn't have time to go and talk about the rabbits of the valley, although he mentions them. Indians apparently were living, the Goshutes of the Tooele Valley were living primarily on rabbits, and the rabbits were the primary source of food. The rabbits would, of course, eat the grasses and other things. But I also found it very interesting to see how the Indians were living on the grass seeds, using the grass seeds for basically their grain supply. The grass seeds were gathered, were used to make their cakes and so forth, and ultimately when the Mormons move in with their herds of cattle, they're causing a further depredation of the Indians because they're wiping out one of the Indians' most basic storable food supplies that would get them through the winter by having their cattle eat all of the grass. And it's not unusual that the Indians would then turn around and see the Mormons having substituted a new food supply, which was the Mormons' cattle and horses, for the food supply that the Mormons had eliminated, which was the grass seeds. Todd talks about how the Goshutes basically were non-horse people. Apparently a horse that fell into their midst was a food supply. They wouldn't keep the horse and ride the horse because the horse would be eating their grasses. And so immediately any horse or cow or large animal of that nature would be eliminated. It is also interesting to see how creative Hamblin becomes in his autobiography. In attributing God's divine intervention to all acts that have happened. You know, obviously got the religion later on, and in the early period of time he was the Mormon warrior and standing up for the pioneers on the against the depredations of the terrible red men. And then subsequently he, like many of us, when he needs a justification for why this or that happened, He has not just one, but several occasions where he talks to Indians later on, and the Indian says, "Oh yes, when you didn't come around that rock or that tree, I was on the other side waiting for you." And the spirit, according to Hamblin, tells him not to do this, and so he doesn't do it. And somehow the spirit is telling him to not go there and saving his life on many occasions. And that, along with the incident that Todd describes of the saving the lives of Indians, Jacob Hamblin tends to ascribe to God's will. God was a terrible manufacturer of caps for guns, apparently. Again, I'm not going to take more time than that. It is a good read. I'm looking forward to seeing the final product when Todd has the book completed. I believe that the impact for me of seeing just how my ancestors, you know, impacted all these Indians when they came to Utah and settled the valleys and thinking that, you know, this is uncharted wilderness. Nobody lives here except for vermin and coyotes and wolves and so forth. If you've ever read some of the early accounts of the Mormons in Salt Lake Valley, it's truly amazing the amount of wildlife that was there. They killed literally thousands of badgers and wolves and foxes and so forth. It was a fertile land for wildlife, and the Indians, of course, had lived in harmony with that wildlife. Mormons came in, killing off the wildlife subsequently through the effect of that, killing off the Indians. I enjoyed Todd's paper and look forward to it. Thank you.
Thank you. Brent, I had an idea of where those horses came from. They were some of the leftover Book of Mormon horses. I had two softball questions. I was going to ask some hardball questions to start off for Todd, but I'm trying to turn over a new leaf and be a nicer person, and so I'm going to ask him a couple of softball questions. One is, Twilla is such an unusual name and spelling, and any of your writing or reading, I know it's really difficult to find out how people pronounced it then, or whether they had trouble pronouncing it, or people that moved in from outside, did they ever struggle with spelling the name, pronouncing the name? And the other question is, as far as the Indians, did Jacob Hamblin make very clear to them that he had no intention to ever kill them, and was it common knowledge that he was safe to be in their midst, that he had kind of a personal commitment that he would never kill them, or did they just slowly figure it out, or they didn't, or whatever?
Okay, one of your softball questions is like a hardball question for anyone else. So, about Twilla, yeah, you see it written all kinds of ways, like T-U-W-I-L-L-A and T-U-L-E and all kinds of ways. As far as pronouncing it, I don't know if they had that much problem, but looking at how they wrote it, you imagine they would. Yeah. Let's see. What was the second one?
Commitment not to kill.
Oh. You know, that's an interesting question. When did Jacob Hamblin first refer to this rebirth he had where he realized he should not kill Indians? And, you know, at this point, you know, maybe I'll find something later, but at this point, the little autobiography is the earliest reference to it I know. So it would be nice to find an earlier reference to it at some point. We have just a hint of it in his holograph autobiography, you know, that after all the Indians got away, no one was killed, they said, "We decided God had some use for these Indians." You know, it was part of God's plan that they shouldn't be killed. And you can see that Jacob, thinking about that, might have developed over time. You don't know whether it was weeks or years, the idea that he should not kill Indians and then he would not be killed himself.
later in life, was it, do you think the Indians knew that he would not kill them? Was that common knowledge?
I think later on, yeah, when he was in southern Utah, he let Indians know that. Yeah, I think that was no secret. But again, where is the earliest primary source that talks about that? That would be a good thing for me to nail down. Yes. Religio-militaristic? Is that a good word? Let me summarize that. That's a wonderful comment. I really would encourage people to come up and talk into the microphone. Yeah, so I'm going to repeat some of it. He mentioned that this early Mormon attitude of being militaristic, looking to kill the Indians, was not just a Western attitude. It was also very similar to the attitude of Moses coming into Canaan and the way the children of Israel coming into Canaan under the leadership of Joshua, Prophet Joshua. Yeah.
First two encounters were Moses himself.
Okay. Okay, he mentioned that Moses was involved. Okay. So, yes, this is a very insightful comment. On top of the Mormons being whites and having a lot of the attitudes of whites, they had this very strong religious and Old Testament overlay. And Mormons were particularly close to the Old Testament. And they saw themselves as the children of Israel, as in the Old Testament. And if they were going into a new Zion, they would see themselves as the children of Israel coming into a new Zion. And the people who were there, they would not see them as being the children of Israel like they were. You know. So, in other words, the land was their inheritance. And there's also another interesting aspect of this in that the Mormons looked at the Indians as children of Israel, but they kind of looked at them. They were ambivalent about the Lamanites. Sometimes they viewed them as children of Israel, we're here to save them, and other times they looked at them as decadent, degraded. You know, these were unrighteous Indians, and so there was a strong religious overlay in this militaristic attitude they had. And in these early military letters, there's some wonderful passages that show this religious point of view in their military. And as I mentioned, in early Mormonism, often the military leaders were also the ecclesiastical leaders. So I remember in one case they killed something like 10, 11, 12, 13 Indians in their camp. They just attacked them, killed them. No Mormons died. But I remember the morning before they took off on this punitive attack, there was this big, long prayer. They described the prayer, you know, and Lord help us in what we're doing. And they viewed themselves as, you know, children of Israel with God on their side, kind of coming into the promised land. So there was that. I think they had a lot of the typical attitudes of a white man coming into the West, but there was definitely that really fascinating overlay of the Mormon / Old Testament there too. And it's interesting that was another thing that Jacob Hamblin would have had to go against. Yeah. Oh, I'd love to have you talk about this on the mic. I'd love to have you talk into the mic.
Let me just make one quick remark. Like most of us, I think it was easier for a lot of the Mormon pioneers to look at the what they would refer to as the advanced Indian tribes, like the Utes, and see more similarity between them and have a much easier time saying, these are the people of children of these are the children of Israel, these are the Lamanites, than it would be to look at some poor Indian who is grubbing in the dirt wearing a rabbit skin loincloth as part of the children of Israel. Just like the rest of us have a hard time dealing with people who live a lifestyle very different than our own.
I had two comments and then a question. Within the last 2 or 3 months, the Salt Lake Tribune editorialized and commented on a finding down in Nephi, where they found, with a construction project right in the middle of Nephi, seven skeletons of Indians. And they concluded that those Indians had been executed by the early pioneers, and they just shed light on that. I've been reading the book, The Black Hawk War, and in that book, in one of those earliest incursions where the pioneers were truly punitive with the Utes in the Utah Valley, they killed about 70 Indians, and terrifyingly enough, they decapitated 40 to 50 of them. And as it turns out, the decapitation was encouraged by an officer from the military named Flake, who accompanied them, and he apparently carried out the first of the decapitations, but the Mormons did the other 40 to 50. Pardon me? Well, in his book, Anderson, talking about the Black Hawk War, calls it 40 to 50. And this is Will Bagley, and he's of particular interest to me, and I think I'd kind of address my question to him, and also to Todd Compton. I've read both of their books. Jacob Hamblin, as I understand it, was in Brigham Young's office on September 1, 1857, with 8 or 9 or 10 Indian chiefs, including Kanosh, before he was sent to the Tooele Valley. And, of course, just 7 or 8 days later, the Mountain Meadows Massacre occurred. And that wouldn't seem that he was too pacifistic then. But the other thing is that at the Mountain Meadow Massacre, and I'm sure Will Bagley could elaborate on this, that the people that painted their face as Indians washed the paint off their faces over there by Jacob Hamblin's cabin or home on his ranch. Pardon me? No, I understand that, but I'm talking about Jacob Hamblin's pacifism. And although he wasn't there personally present, his ranch was very much used in connection with that. And one of the little children that was repatriated to Arkansas commented that he saw those people wash the paint off their faces over at Jacob Hamblin's ranch. I just wonder if he really was a pacifist.
I don't know what. Oh, in the...
What does he say?
Oh, is this where he goes after Bigfoot you're talking about?
What he says is...
I wondered if I was wrong, you know, and so he was interested in killing Bigfoot again.
No.
And Will has mentioned that after this experience, in I guess it's in Little, he says, well, there was one other really bad Indian who I thought maybe should be killed. And so that's evidence that this conversion was not immediate for Hamblin.
Did they kill Bigfoot?
No, they didn't. They didn't. But again, he was prevented from killing Bigfoot. So that might have helped toward the conversion also. And these other comments about the Mountain Meadows Massacre, you know, I don't think I've researched that as thoroughly as I could to really answer that at this point. But I personally, I don't think he would have stopped being pacifist at that time. And of course, I don't think he was involved in planning the Mountain Meadows Massacre or anything like that. Okay, could you speak in the mic, please? Oh.
Todd, I found this particularly interesting because both my parents are from Twilla, and the Daniel England who drew that map of the stockade of Twilla in 1857 or something was my great-great-grandfather. My great-grandfather ended up the Indian agent in Rush Valley, and based on family journals and so on, at that point he felt quite at ease of going off running around Rush Valley and leaving his wife and children at home alone. What happened in between the time that you're describing and the 1890s when this happened? Was the Indian population so low it was no longer a problem? Had they reached some kind of accommodation? Had they killed off so many Indians it didn't make any difference? What happened to end this kind of confrontational mode that you were talking about and get into a little more of a coexistence?
Especially in Grantsville, there was someone named Harrison Sevier who was kind of like Hamblin in trying to develop really good relationships with Indians. And there are accounts of, you know, a whole bunch of Indians coming in and living in Grantsville. And the Goshutes were not, you know, a really warlike group as opposed to the Utes. And this was a very good comment that in these thefts, it's possible that there was either they were done by Utes, and that early one, when two sources, including Hamblin, explicitly say it was Utes, or they were influential in coming into Goshute territory and maybe heading groups that would raid the livestock, and if they had a horse or two, that would, you know, from the Utes, that would help. And so that was a very good comment. And the interrelations between the Indians in Utah were very complex, very complex.
They're all put on the
resume. Oh, yeah. Yeah. In Tooele, again, Jacob Hamblin left in 1854. He left Tooele. So I haven't focused my research past then. It's part of the ignorance of a researcher. But in overviews of Goshute, you know, Mormon relations, my impression is that there were these little outbreaks here and there, periodically, but they gradually, were at peace, and they were put on reservations gradually, which is not a good, you know, and they were not given the most choice land to go on reservation, so it was not a good resolution for the Goshutes, but that's basically what happened, as I understand it.
Well, thank you all for coming out, and I appreciate Todd and Brent and their comments and their time that they've taken. Todd has another child on the way, so this obscure book that you may have heard of, In Sacred Loneliness, the Pearl Wives of Joseph Smith, I think is available for sale in the book area. Thank you.